Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Almost every culture has a way to use day-old bread. You have, you know, French toast, which the French call pain perdu, which means forgotten bread. The panzanella salad is a perfect example of that.
With Chef Daniel Orr today, we'll be making a dish that uses up all those stale bits of bread that you can't bring yourself to throw in the compost heap. Hi guys, I'm Mark Chilla, filling in for Annie, who's out of the office this week. Also on our show, the benefits and limitations of urban gardens. A story from Harvest Public Media. We'll also hear how female farmers in Missouri are banding together. Then it's a trip to the garden, where the seeds are considered more valuable than the vegetables. And don't try this at home, the pros and cons of dumpster diving. I'm happy again to welcome Yael Cassander to Earth Eats, bringing us the latest food news.
A recall from flour giant General Mills expanded this week from 30 million pounds to a total of 45 million due to an E. coli outbreak spanning 21 states. The first recall was announced in May and increased for the first time at the beginning of July. 46 people have been infected so far, sending 13 to the hospital. Those cases are linked to people eating or handling raw dough or batter. A list of recalled products, package sizes, and production dates can be found on the Centers for Disease Control website. The U.S. Secretary of Agriculture says he's hopeful that Congress will approve a massive trade deal before his tenure is up. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, would help Midwest farmers and ranchers get goods into markets like Japan and Vietnam. Vilsack says it's up to Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Congress to carry the deal across the finish line with an up or down vote.
I think it's an important consideration, and I would hope that Senator McConnell would see the wisdom of putting it up for a vote. Whether it passes or not, it's anybody's guess, but it deserves a vote.
Critics of the trade deal, including both Republican and Democratic presidential candidates, say it will result in jobs moving overseas. Congress has yet to take it up. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
A Seattle startup has invented a way to recapture a byproduct of coffee farming, the sweet, vitamin-rich fruit surrounding the bean. Farmers usually have to dispose of this flesh, which spoils almost immediately after harvest. Founder Dan Beliveau developed a way to dry the fruit and grind it into a durable flour. The powder has a little leftover caffeine and can be used to add a zip to baked goods, pasta, candy, or even steeped into a tea. Beliveau's company, Coffee Flour, cranked out 4.5 million pounds of the stuff last year, recycling waste from farms from Central America to Southeast Asia. The pulp can be composted for fertilizer, but provides only a little benefit for building soil. Farmers who sell the pulp can make an extra 3 cents per pound on a crop that often yields only 5 to 10 cents of profit per pound. Our news reporters Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow report on stories all week long. You can read them at eartheats.org.
We're on Twitter, too, posting news updates and lots of recipes. Find us at Earth Eats. Yael Cassander, thanks for helping us out.
Sure thing.
Urban farms and gardens are trendy. They're touted as the key to a sustainable lifestyle, as creating healthy, vibrant communities and promoting economic development. But a new study says, not so fast. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Suzanne Hogan has the story.
They're hot today. They're hanging out in the shade.
Neil Rudisil is a farmer. He has chickens and dozens of crops, growing tomatoes, greens, and onions. But he's not your typical farmer. He and his partner purchased this spot in the heart of Kansas City's inner city just a few years ago. They bought two houses that have needed some work.
The gutting I did do by myself. Lisa helped out too, my partner.
And they bought the vacant properties around the homes, transforming the area into an urban farm. Last year, they brought in $10,000 from selling their produce to local restaurants and farmers markets.
I can't think of a better way to use some of these vacant parcels than food production, because it does so much. Bring in income, bring good food, you know, help fight climate change, a place for mobilizing your neighbors.
Rudisill also has money coming in from another source. He just took a job with the Neighborhood Association, promoting urban gardening in the community. And his message resonates with his neighbor, Sandra Wheeler, who grew up in the house across the street.
I've sat here for the past 2 years and I've watched Neil and learn how he's done his.
Wheeler says blight and crime once plagued the neighborhood, but in the past 10 years, the area has gone through a renaissance. And now the community can focus more on what she calls the fun stuff, like beautifying the area and raising gardens.
So my interest is that the lot on the east side of me, I want to actually purchase that so I could do the same thing.
This is the kind of feel-good story you hear a lot about urban agriculture projects. But a new study released by the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future says urban ag proponents need to be careful about overselling all the benefits. And they need to be honest when it comes to some of the limitations. Rachel Santo is a co-author of the study. I spoke with her on Skype.
How do you quantify improved community diversity and cooperation and, you know, intergenerational knowledge exchange?
Santo says those unquantifiable things, the community building aspects, are some of urban agriculture's greatest assets, in addition to promoting healthy living and ecological diversity. But it's the quantifiable promises, like the economic kind, where research falls short.
There's very little evidence of a significant number of jobs, let alone livable wage jobs, being created by urban agriculture.
And there is this question of sustainability. Like, can we really grow enough food within cities to feed everybody who lives in them? Santo says there would have to be a real shift in what people expect to be able to eat year-round. And it would also take addressing some important disparities.
A lot of the community gardens and urban farms aren't necessarily feeding the communities in which they're located.
There's a lot of cheap vacant land in low-income neighborhoods, and lots of times the people with the money coming in to start projects are outsiders. Santo says people in those situations need to be sensitive to that, more inclusive, and open to their neighbors to avoid creating rifts in the community.
A lot of times people try to pair the benefits of urban agriculture or lump them all together, but they might vary based on the type and the main aim of the organization.
What type of tomatoes are they?
You know, there's a variety.
Catherine Kelly runs Cultivate KC, a nonprofit group in Kansas City that works with the mixed bag of everything urban agriculture covers, from a front yard garden plot to a community garden to small farms just outside of the city center.
The truth is that urban agriculture is one of a number of strategies to address all of that array of issues. It's one strategy to address vacant lots. It's one strategy to address, you know, climate change. It's one strategy to address disconnection from food.
Kelly says the explosion of urban agriculture projects over the last few decades have led to more opportunities to understand how these projects can fit into a community.
What are the models that are good for the farmer, good for the community, good for the environment, good for the consumer?
And she says it's really about getting people to think more about where their food comes from, whether it's from a big farm out in the country or from closer to their front yard. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
A couple of recipes now from our archives with Chef Daniel Orr. Two of the most colorful recipes he's made for Earth Eats, actually. He's going to show Annie how to make good use of stale bread. But first up, Daniel is in his mom's massive garden in Columbus, Indiana. On that day, it was the okra that got him inspired.
And we're picking some of, look, see this okra here? It looks kind of like a finger. And actually in the Caribbean, they call it ladies' fingers. You see the flower here? It's a type of a hibiscus. So, you know, it flowers, the fruit comes right off the flower. And what you want to do is to pick them when they're really small. And I like them when they're about an inch long. And that's it. We've got a nice little handful. It's enough for a couple salads here. So here we go. Simple summer salad. Ingredients that come out of any garden that's of any decent size here in the Midwest. So we have got our tomatoes. I've got several different varieties. I've got some nice golden ones and some red zebra tomatoes. I've got some red onions, some tomatillos, a little bit of garlic chili, and the okra. We can do about equal amounts. So I would say if you have about a cup to a cup and a half of each of those vegetables, that would be fine. So we're just going to add those to the bowl. Now for flavoring, I'm going to put a few chili rings. Now these are that I'm using are cayenne, so they're these little red ones. They're quite spicy, but we're not going to use that many of them. And we're going to add a little lemon zest, which, you know, lemon zest gives you that nice citrusy, zesty taste. Okay, and we're going to finish it with the okra. Now, with the okra, I'm just going to cut them in half lengthwise so you really can see what they are. I'm going to leave the little tops on them because they're so young and tender, you don't need to worry about those being tough or chewy. Now, we're going to drizzle that with a little bit of honey, probably about a tablespoon. Okay, and then what's important about this salad is that you put the vinegar on. And what the vinegar does is it keeps that filmy, slimy stuff from forming. So it's very important you get that vinegar on early, right after you cut them. Okay, and we're just going to put a touch of olive oil in, a little salt and pepper, freshly ground pepper always. All right, and that's all there is to the salad. You can see it looks almost like carnival time. It's, it's so colorful and vibrant. All right, well, we're going to be going to Italy on this recipe. Almost every culture has a way to use day-old bread. You have, you know, French toast, which the French call pan perdu, which means forgotten bread. The panzanella salad is a perfect example of that. I've got some of our really great croutons. I'm going to add some of that, and I've baked these off with some Parmesan cheese, olive oil, salt, and pepper, but you could just use some chopped up day-old bread. Now, since these are quite dry, I'm going to just add about a quarter cup of hot water and toss those in there, and that's going to start moistening those up as I ready the other ingredients. All right, so I added two small rounds of fresh mozzarella. Mozzarella is going to give it that richness. It's a very mild cheese, but it has that sweet milky flavor. And to that, I'm going to add one medium red onion, which I'm peeling, and then I'm going to cut into julienne, which are fine strips.
Now some beautiful sun-dried tomatoes.
Yep, we're going to roughly chop those. And so what that's doing, a traditional panzanella is very, very simple. Just, you know, tomatoes, onions, basil, cucumbers, and of course the bread. But we want to have multiple layers of flavor. So the sun-dried tomatoes are going to give it kind of a deep, rich, sweet, almost raisiny tomato flavor. Then I've got our globe tomatoes, which are the big round tomatoes. Okay, to that we're going to also add some cherry tomatoes. And with cherry tomatoes, I always like to cut them in half because when you try to chase them around the plate with a fork, they kind of shoot off the plate or they squirt you in the eye. So do you and your guests a favor and cut your cherry tomatoes in half. Okay, I've got some great basil. Now look at this jumbo basil. My mother brought it up from Gibson County, God's country.
What's her trick for growing such gigantic basil leaves?
Compost. We keep all of our green waste from preparation here at the restaurant, and we have 5-gallon buckets. We send it down to the farm. That gets composted with the bedding from underneath the chicken coops and all that stuff. Sits for about 10 months to a year, and then we can use it in the vegetable garden. Good handful of that in there, probably about a cup and a half. Now I'm going to smash some garlic, so I've got these peeled cloves. And then what I like to do after I've got it pretty much chopped is take the side of your knife, press it down there, and you're going to smash that. And that's going to bring out those essential oils and those flavors of the garlic, almost make like a paste. A lot of people like to throw a little bit of salt on there as they do that. I've got a little herb de Provence, and that has some summer savory, thyme, a little bit of rosemary. I also like to put a little bit of lavender in there. And basically now we're just going to build the vinaigrette right on top of this. We don't have to make the vinaigrette separately. Half cup of olive oil. And we're gonna toss that all together. And you can look and you can see these colors. I mean, it looks like an Italian flag. You got that white mozzarella, the green basil, and the the red tomatoes, all those beautiful Italian colors. Now we're just going to squeeze some lemon juice over it, and then we're going to season it with some salt and pepper. Okay, I'm going to toss that nicely. And again, of course, we're going to give it a taste. The bread's perfect. It still has a little crunch to it, but started absorbing all those flavors. It looks good. Looks like we're there.
Good Stuff with Daniel Orr. These recipes are collected on our website, and if you haven't seen recipes by our newest blogger, Barbara Brozier, you gotta check them out. Slow cooker pulled pork and tomato basil scones. They're at eartheats.org. Coming up, we'll meet a dumpster diver who says he's become a better cook thanks to his unusual hobby.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
You're tuned to Earth Eats. I'm Mark Chilla, in for Annie Corrigan today. Farming is still thought of as a male-dominated field, but there are thousands of women farmers across the country, often left in the shadows. Suzanne Hogan, again, for Harvest Public Media, met up with women farmers looking for the support they need to give their business an edge.
Ever since Aubrey Fletcher was a little girl, she knew she wanted to work on a dairy farm.
I do remember my mom asking, "Are you sure this is what you want to do?"
Fletcher says she knew the work was hard. She grew up milking cows every day. Now she and her husband's family run Edgewood Creamery outside of Springfield, Missouri, and she loves it. Inside the barn, Fletcher shows me the newest additions to the herd, a few calves who were born earlier in the week. Using her fingers, she teaches the young heifers how to get used to using a bottle.
It takes them a little bit, but it doesn't take them long. They're quick learners.
And as we drive the small work truck to check out the older cows in the pasture, Fletcher tells me their dairy is expecting 300 more calves this year. That will add an extra load to an already busy schedule between milkings, feedings, and fixing things that need fixing.
There's always something to be done on the farm, and very rarely my house gets cleaned, so.
In the United States, a third of farms are run by couples like the Fletchers, sharing the workload and daily responsibilities. And in the past 15 years, the fraction of women who are taking the lead on the farms has nearly tripled. Now it's about 15%. Fletcher meets regularly with a new group of women dairy farmers, and she says having a space to come together with other women has been huge.
Because they can relate to you. They understand, oh, you had three calves this morning and, you know, you didn't get your kids to school on time. You know, they understand the struggles of being a dairy farm wife slash mom, and it's easy to just talk to them about the struggles of a dairy farm and talk about the good times.
And it's not just about the social and emotional support. Education has been the main component. Reagan Bluell is a dairy specialist for the University of Missouri Extension. We talked on Skype. She runs the group of women dairy farmers.
This is another forum to gather information both from Extension, but also from their peers to see what is successful on those farms.
Bluell says the daily grind of agricultural work can make it hard for farmers to get off the farm. But they've been making the time, the first Monday every other month.
365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It can be very isolating. And so sometimes it takes scheduling yourself to leave the farm.
Bluell polled the women to find out what they want to learn about. And in the next few months, she'll program sessions about everything from calf raising to stress management.
They've been through the ups and downs of the milk price, and they see how knowledge can then translate to successes within their herd.
Many women are used to standing out at big farm shows or meetings. And that's why Rebecca Conley started a group for women in dairy in Pennsylvania.
Women on farms has always been there. It's just now women are looking for more information off the farm.
Conley says the women want more training. They're seeking out more entrepreneurial opportunities, like starting a creamery. They're trying to bring a competitive edge to their farm. What she's hearing from her group?
Work-home balance was a big one, and also value-added products.
Which is something Aubrey Fletcher back at Edgewood Creamery can relate to. The idea to start their creamery came from her and her husband's desire to return to his family farm.
The farm couldn't necessarily provide both of us with salaries, and so we thought, why not take our premium milk and take that a little further?
A year in, Fletcher says the creamery is helping the dairy stay afloat. They just opened a small storefront on the farm, selling their milk and cheese. And she and her husband are building the business and the life they wanted. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
There are half a dozen Harvest reporters stationed all around the country. Their stories are collected at harvestpublicmedia.org. When we interview folks for Earth Eats, one of the most important things we do is ask people to say and spell their names. With this conversation, Annie actually forgot to ask him to do this until the interview was over.
Thank you so much. Oh, I think I didn't have you say your name and spell your name.
Oh, what?
Do you not want your
name? I kind of don't, for the sake of future Google searches. That's one thing I hate. I hate when people, when the first thing people know about me is, oh, that's he digs through the trash. That's weird. I love that. It's part of what I do.
So for anonymity's sake, let's just call him Mr. Dumpster Diver. Dumpster diving is not the safest and certainly not the most legal thing to do. But consider this. Up to 40% of the food that's grown, processed, and transported in the U.S. will get thrown away. Annie met him behind a grocery store in downtown Indianapolis, where he showed her some of the tricks of the trade.
I've never done this before, but you say you're not worried.
I'm not worried. I used to be concerned about whether or not it was legal, and now I'm just concerned more about whether or not it's moral. And I feel like I don't know if it's legal. I think it is.
It's the trespassing thing that would potentially be a problem.
That's what I understand. But you know, if they tell me to leave, I leave. I don't put up a fight, and I just try and make sure that I'm not memorable.
Well, so we're walking around back now. We're approaching the dumpster in downtown Indy behind an Aldi's. That'll be about as specific as we get about our location. How about that?
Yeah, that's fine.
Tell me how you found this spot as a good spot to come and dumpster dive.
Just driving past. If I've got a lunch break or something and I see a grocery store nearby, I might give it a shot and see what's up. Sometimes I'm lucky, sometimes I'm not. Early today, I went out and I swung by another location and found a bunch of tomatoes, a bunch of lettuce.
Is there anything you will not take from a dumpster?
I don't take food that I don't like. I used to draw the line at meat, but that line has blurred drastically. And I feel like my life is better for it because I've, believe it or not, never got sick from eating anything out of the trash.
What's like the greatest, most amazing dumpster find that you've had?
Ice cream's a really good find. If you can find that and it's still cold, like they just threw it out, then it just kind of feels like you're just in the right spot at the right time and everything in the world is right. And it's completely empty except for a pack of bananas. They're in good shape. I actually think I might grab it. It's kind of a bust, and that happens sometimes. Just kind of luck of the draw, I guess.
Bananas, you got, I don't know, a dozen bananas. You can make some killer banana bread out of that.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. They're not in the best shape. There's a couple in here that I might, you know, be able to eat over the next couple days. Dumpster diving has made me a better cook, for sure, because I come home with a bunch of random ingredients and I gotta find a way to use them. So you know, I find some way to use them.
Oh, I love trash. Anything dirty or dingy or dusty. Anything ragged or rotten or rusty.
The garden at the Wiley House Museum is thriving this time of year, but most of the gorgeous produce won't be eaten. It will be allowed to ripen past the edible stage. That's because these crops are valued for their seeds.
So it's kind of a wild combination of seeds that haven't been cleaned yet.
The one person who gets to sneak a bite of the produce on occasion is Sherry Wise, coordinator of the museum's garden and seed-saving program. She will taste a cucumber, say, to make sure its seeds are worth preserving. EarthEats' Tara Cobb got a tour of the Wiley House's seed-saving setup.
So we pick seeds. They're all heirloom, open-pollinated varieties, which means that if you start them from seed again, you'll get the same thing as the plant they were collected. So they're non-hybrid. For instance, a bean pod, it's as simple as letting the pod go from green to brown. And when they're brown, then we know that the seeds are mature and ready to be collected. And that it's as simple as opening the pod, and there are the seeds.
They're ready to be planted.
Yeah. Or stored. Are best stored with just the seeds and none of the chaff, which includes the flowers, the stems, the seed covers. So what we want are just the seeds. So you can see here it's a whole lot of stuff. Then winnowing, you just lightly shake the tray and blow on it, and then you end up with the seeds and not all the junk. We can walk out to the garden.
Okay, let's do that.
Here we got the little bitty kale plants, and these are radishes. These are called walking onions, and they were used during the Civil War to treat gunshot wounds. And the juice from the onions has antiseptic qualities. It was said that General Grant wouldn't move his troops without his supply of onions.
Sherry Wise is the outdoor interpreter at the Wiley House Museum. She runs the Heirloom Garden and Seed Saving Program.
With the help of a lot of volunteers. In fact, that's my mother right there. She's been working all morning.
Thanks to Tara Cobb for this story. She was an intern at EarthEats in 2014. We got a lot of people helping us out, too. Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow track down news stories. Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington brings us recipes. Aobon Binder keeps the website running smoothly. And John Bailey of WFIU is the executive producer.
Production support for EarthEats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. EarthEats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
I've had a lot of fun today, but Annie will be back at the helm next week. Thanks for being with me. I'm Mark Chilla.